Dear, question number one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, please talk about feeling limiters. I'm more of a feeling person, not visual. Can I work with those to get into jhanas? The feeling limiters. You can work with anything but those who have feeling limiters. It's more difficult because you're not really quite sure where you are. With the lights, they're very easy to see. And they're very, very easy to work with. You know whether they're bright or whether they are dull, whether they are moving around. But feelings, it's very hard to be able to stabilize them and intensify them. That's why that they're not the best way. And unless you're a blind person, you know, I don't think anyone here is blind, so you have a visual sense. So it is usually easier to use the visual limiters. And don't be concerned, because they'll come up anyway, whether you're a visual person or not. It's just what happens when you are kindful and your mind gets really still. So still that there's nothing moving. So all those other things which stop you seeing these limiters, all the thoughts, all the agitation, all the other stuff which goes on, is all settled down, all dealt with, all disappeared, until the limiters are the only things left. So if you are going to go with the feeling limiters, number one, make sure it's not a real physical feeling. Your body has disappeared, gone, kaput. You don't know what's happened to it. You can't feel. If somebody tapped you on the shoulder, you wouldn't know. The limiters are so strong. You can't hear, you can't see, you can't smell or taste. If someone let out wind, you wouldn't smell it. That is a sign that you have got into this nimitta stage. Because what it is, the five external senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, have all been subdued, calmed, so they vanish. So now you're in the sixth sense world, the realm of the mind. That's what's happening. That's what we do with this meditation in order for us to understand what is this mind. First little simile of... These are old similes, but look, you make up a simile. It's very hard to get one which really fits. And this fits. Once there was an emperor. This is the emperor simile. And the emperor was very powerful, not to be someone trifled with. But the problem was, no one knew who the emperor really was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, the emperor was covered with five pieces of clothing, which overlapped, so you could not see what was underneath. The emperor had boots which went up to his thighs, trousers which overlapped the top of his boots and went up to his waist, had a jacket which overlapped the top of the trousers with long sleeves and a high collar. The emperor had gloves which overlapped the end of the jacket sleeves, and lastly a helmet, which totally covered the face and overlapped the top of the jacket. So the five pieces of clothing, the helmet, the jacket, the gloves, the trousers and the boots, completely covered the emperor, so no one knew who the emperor was. And in this simile, those five pieces of clothing stand for your five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. And the emperor is your mind, the one in charge of everything. And when it's covered completely with these five senses, you just can't understand what the mind really is. Who is it who is looking at me right now? What is it which is listening to me? What is it that knows that it knows? This is a thing we call the mind. And the only way to understand what the emperor is, whether it's a boy or a girl, whether it's an old person or young or middle-aged like me, whether it's fat, skinny, or just right, again, like me. The only way to find out is to take all the clothes off, and then you can see the emperor for what the emperor truly is. And that's the only way you can understand the mind. To let the five senses totally vanish, disappear, go, so you can see what's left. And this is the first time you see what's left when the nimitta comes up in your mind. And the way you undress this thing you call you is to be still. Because when things are still, they disappear. They go. Sight vanishes and all the rest vanish. And then you can see who is the emperor running this show. Fascinating, isn't it? But that's actually how it works. So that is what you do to the nimittas come up when the body is just about gone. And it's not that hard to let go of all these senses. The most important reason you can let them go is because stillness is so delightful. Never underestimate developing the happiness in meditation. The old story, there was a couple of Malaysians living in Australia who told me this story. They were at home watching a movie. And once the movie was finished, they got up, one to go to the toilet, the other one to go and put a kettle on to make a cup of tea. As they got up from the sofa, they noticed that even their living room had changed. There were many things missing. And they soon checked, and sure enough, a burglar had been in their house while they were watching the TV. And they were so absorbed in the box, they didn't even hear the burglar who came right behind the sofa to take expensive stuff off the shelf, maybe 2 foot behind them. If only you could meditate like that. Instead, somebody comes in behind you, hear every rustle, every footstep. Why is that? What's the difference between meditation and watching a movie? The difference is you're interested in the movie. It's delightful. You do get absorbed into it. Now you understand how to let go of the five senses. The mind gets so peaceful, so beautiful, you just can't hear anything. You can't feel anything. It is the joy, the interest, the beauty, which is one of the keys to being still. Next question, why is analytical meditation not taught in the Theravada tradition? Oh God, analytical meditation, you analyze over much. You don't get anywhere with analysis. You know, that's what you do in chemistry and physics and stuff like that. That's what I did for years before I became a monk. It really stuffed up your brain. So instead of analyzing things so much, keep it still, for goodness sake. Analyzing is more brain work. If you want to see things and understand the truth, you don't get very far with analysis. But you get everywhere with stillness. The great simile is the lake in the mountains. If that lake in the mountains has got one wave on the surface, a few ripples, it will distort the reflection of everything which surrounds it. But only when that mountain lake is perfectly still, without one ripple, only then will it perfectly reflect the truth and beauty which surrounds it. If you want to understand things and see things, you understand these things through stillness, not through analysis. If you want to know this in Pali, just to give authority to what I say, it is a saying of the Buddha repeated maybe 100 times in the Pali Sutras, Samadhi Paccaya Yathabhuta Jnana Dasana. Stillness is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. For wisdom, for insight, stillness is the cause, the paccaya. but seeing things as they truly are. Not thinking. Stillness. If you want to be wise, be still. If you want to be stupid and get headache, analyze. So, I'm being a bit tough, but that's actually the truth of things. Dear Ajahn, according to the commentary, there are three levels of samadhi. Kanika Samadhi, Upachara Samadhi, and Jhana. Some monks' books say that we only need the stillness at the Upachara Samadhi level to contemplate the Dhamma and get enlightened. Thus, the third level of Jhana is not necessary. Please share with us your insight on why there is this misunderstanding. Three bows from somebody. Now, this is a commentary which was written maybe, well, it's actually the, it was codified, well, it's actually written 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. That's a long time after the time of the Buddha. The Buddha never mentioned these three types. And in fact, one of these types is what we call an oxymoron. An oxymoron is two words you put together which mean the opposite of each other. For example, light, darkness. You can't have light, darkness. It's either light or it's dark. You can't have darkness which is light or light, darkness. You can't have sour, sweet. Sweet and sour, that's together, but you know, it's one or the other. And kanika means momentary. Samadhi means stillness. Momentary stillness, if it's only still for a moment, it's not still. So this is actually absolute ridiculous stupidity, and anyone with any brain would actually pick this apart straight away. The problem is, a lot of times in Buddhism, because it was an Asian religion, people just follow their teachers without question. A lot of times you wouldn't be allowed to ask questions of the teacher, or challenge them, or say, I don't agree with you. And because of that, in Asian countries for a long time, people get told this stuff, this Gomayang, and they keep on believing it. And you take some, you know, especially the Western monks who've got brains, who look at the sutras, and who aren't afraid of questioning, and say, this is rubbish. Upachara Samadhi is neighbor. That, okay, that exists. That's the when you get nimittas. That's upachara. Upachara means like the neighborhood. You're very close to jhanas. But you must know that the threshold, the, if you like, the doormat, you step over the doormat to get in a house, but you also step over it to get out of the house. And it's that particular samadhi, that stillness, after the jhana, that is the place you get enlightened, not before. Because before you have the jhanas, that particular stillness is not stable enough. It's very easy to disappear, and it's also very difficult to know whether that is upachara or not. The only way you know you're at the threshold of the house is if you actually go into the house, one more step and you're in. And it is totally ridiculous why, if you're so close to jhana, why you don't get in there. You have to get those jhanas. This commentary, the reason I'm quite fierce on this is because these sorts of teachings stop people from getting enlightened. They're not just, you know, a different opinion. They actually stop people seeing the truth. The Buddha became enlightened by getting jhanas. And in Dhammapada, verse 372, Nati jhanang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jhanang chapanya chasa ve nibbana santike. Again, I'm just trying to impress you. I know my stuff. There is no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. But in one who has wisdom and jhana, they are in the presence of nibbana. You need the two. You need the wisdom. You need the jhana as well. Without the jhana, there's no hope. So the reason why some books say this is because monks like me, who say you need the jhana, we lose our popularity. If I didn't tell jokes, you wouldn't follow me. Simply because you can go to the monk next door
And he said, I don't need jhana. It's easier. I don't need jhana. I can still get enlightened. It's called dumbing down enlightenment. You know, the more dumb, you know, you make it, basically people think it's easier. Well, I can do it now. I don't need jhana. Well, thank goodness for that. But unfortunately, I am very honest with you. You know, I have integrity. You know, I know that jhanas are necessary, so you know, you have to get them. And there's no reason why not. They're just stages of stillness. The more still you get, the more close to jhana. So it's just what happens. You get jhana whether you like it or not. And I'm going to be another controversial here. The monks who say it's not necessary are the monks who have never experienced jhana. Anyone who's really experienced the proper jhana, just they know what they're talking about. They know, my God, it is necessary. They know exactly what they're talking about. But some monks, especially the monks who write the books, and actually I write books, don't I? But you know, the scholar monks spend so much time writing the books that they don't actually do any meditation. They try and convince other people it's not necessary because they haven't done the jhanas themselves, basically. Any comment about that? Yeah, go on. Yeah, exactly, yeah. That's very good. All the time the Buddha mentioned the way to become enlightened is always eightfold path. The way to become a stream winner, eightfold path. Everything is eightfold path. And the Buddha was very compassionate. If there was a shortcut, he would have said sevenfold path. Out of kindness to each one of you and me as well. But the reason is that eightfold path is because every one of those eight factors is absolutely necessary. You know, some people think, you know, you don't even need factor four, five, and six. Oh, forget about precepts. You know, you don't have to have right speech. You can lie as long as you're mindful. You know, you can have sex as long as you're mindful. As long as you're not attached. Hey, come on. These are principles which we have to let go. And when you understand that, you understand every one of those factors is absolutely necessary. All the factors of your virtue, so 3, 4, and 5, and also mindfulness is necessary, as is the stillness of samadhi, of jhana, sama samadhi. It's necessary.
Maybe the problem is about the interpretation of the word samadhi.
Yes. Okay.
Samadhi as momentarily, yep. Illness, then that's where the problem arise. So they still said you have to follow the eightfold path. However, the eighth path is what's got wrong.
Yes, very good. You're saying that they say yes, you have to follow the eightfold path, but the last factor, sama samadhi, they say it can include these other things. In the suttas, that probably that factor is defined more than any other factor. And it's consistently, I don't know how many times, maybe 200 times, always defined the same way. Sama samadhi means first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the definition of sama samadhi, the four jhanas. Nothing else is mentioned by the Buddha. Just four jhanas, every time. So it means that people aren't really following the teachings of the Buddha when they try and interpret sama samadhi to be something different. It's always precisely the same. That's why it's great that you read these teachings of the Buddha yourself. They've got excellent translations now, or pretty good translations now. You can read them in English and you come across, and it's so obvious, you come again and again and again. Sama samadhi. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Sama samadhi. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Sama samadhi. And it really is repetitive. But I mean, you see it so often, there's no doubt in your mind at all, if you read it for yourself, that sama samadhi does mean the four jhanas. And even in the Gopika Moggallana Sutra, that's 108 of the, somewhere around there, 128, one of those two. Of the Majjhima Nikaya, there, it's after the Buddha passed away. And somebody asked Ananda, who was, you know, been with the Buddha for about 25 years, in the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, they asked him, what type of meditation did the Buddha encourage? What did he teach? What did he praise? And Ananda replied, the Buddha only encouraged and praised four types of meditation. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. It's again and again, it's so obvious. So it's sometimes the people who haven't experienced those jhanas, sometimes to try and justify their inability, they say it's not necessary. But it is. Anyway, is being sick a way of paying karma? No. You don't have to pay karma with sick. Paying karma, it's not paying karma. Look, you've got a whole heap of bad karma, and you've got a whole heap of good karma. You know, which one do you want to sort of get out of the bank account? This is one thing which really interested me about the law of karma. The way it was described, I understand it works myself. If you do a bad act, you kick the dog, you don't just get kicked once, you get kicked 100 times. It's not just, tit for tat. One tit and you've got 100 tats afterwards. That's just the way that karma works. If you do something bad, you pay the price many times over. If you do something good, you get reward 100,000 times over. So it means all your actions, they get multiplied. So you have this whole mountain of bad karma. And you have this whole mountain of good karma as well. You can't exhaust the bad karma. There's just too much of it. And you can't even exhaust the good karma. There's too much of that also. So why do you get bad karma? A lot of times it's because we're negative that we resonate with bad stuff from the past. We bring up that bad karma. We actually draw off the bad karma account because of negative mind states. And that's a stupid thing to do. Instead, draw off the good karma account. Right, 2 ATMs. And which one are you going to draw off? Draw off the good ATM account. They say in modern economics, the good banks and the bad banks. The bad banks carry all the debt, the good ones carry all the assets. So your assets are huge. Draw off them. And how do you draw off your good karma? By remembering it. Reflecting on it, thinking of all the great things you've done, all the kindness which you've done, all the times you've, given a cup of tea or a plate of cheese to the monks down here, all those other stuff. When you really think about it, wow, I've done a huge amount of good karma. When you think about that, straight away you resonate with good karma from the past, and you get energy, you get happiness, and you even get good health as well. That's actually in the Bojanga Sutta. This is some of the chants which the monks are supposed to chant when people are sick. The only reason this works is because when these were done in the time of the Buddha, people actually understood what was being said. And it wasn't some just hocus-pocus chant, it was actually a teaching. And these were the cases when there was a couple of disciples of the Buddha who were sick, and the Buddha just taught them Dhamma. And they got inspired, they remembered all these amazing achievements they had. And just remembering that, catching up on their good karma, the sickness totally ended. My own story, which is not quite the same as what happened in the Bojanga Sutta, when I was a student, I was staying in a house with a number of other students. And one day I got the flu, terrible cold, no way you could go to the lectures. So I was in bed. Okay, nose, sort of sneezing and all this yuck coming out of your nose, coughing, feeling really terrible. And I was in bed suffering. And because all my friends were out doing their lectures, when somebody knocked on the door and they kept on knocking, I just dragged myself out of my deathbed to the front door, opened it, and it was a delivery for me. And it was my hi-fi system. If you can remember those days before iPods, You had all these boxes of equipment, you know, which you could play if you remember the vinyl records. For those of you who know, it was really difficult in those days. It's so easy, just press a button, you have to put everything together, plug it in, and just make sure everything was working properly. But this was my hi-fi system. And I was so excited, and even though I was feeling sick, I put it all together. It took about half an hour, plugged it all in, and put my first vinyl record, Jimi Hendrix, on. And I was so happy, but I realized my cold had totally disappeared. And it was amazing. I mean, this is no joke. Now I was sneezing, felt terrible, and now it had totally vanished. It wasn't imagination, you know, because you had all the symptoms, all the snot coming out of your nose and coughing and everything. And now it all stopped, and I felt great. And I realized, my goodness, the power of happiness to actually overcome sickness is huge. So look, if ever I get really sick, you know, and I'm in my room somewhere, just, you know, get out of Jimi Hendrix LP.
No, don't do that. It's against my rules.
So it's not paying off bad karma. It is, you know, it's part of nature, but of course it's not being sick, it's how you're sick. So you can be sick and be miserable. Or you can be sick and think of all the benefits of being sick. So what are the benefits of being sick? Number one, you don't have to go to work. You've got the day off. Great. I don't have to go through the traffic in Singapore. I don't have to face that angry boss. And I can be in my nice bed all day because I'm sick. Number two, you allow all the people who love you to be compassionate to you. You're a vehicle for them to practice their compassion. What would the point of being compassionate if no one was sick? So every now and again, you volunteer, okay, I'm going to be sick today, so that you can practice compassion. So tell that to your husband. Husband, darling, you know, I'm sick today because you really, really need to practice your compassion on me. Hamper me. And it is really nice looking after sick people, you know, because they really need some TLC. They need some help. It's so hard being compassionate when everyone is so independent, healthy and strong. And you can't help them. But when someone is really needy, they really need like a cup of tea or they need some soup or something, isn't it wonderful? You can actually give them something. I really enjoy doing that. If you ever had the opportunity to look after someone who's sick, you get fun out of that. So when you're sick, you're given the opportunity of other people to make good karma. So what a benefit that is, being sick. And number three, it realizes you're not in control of your body. Because when you get sick, it's usually the most inconvenient times. You usually sneeze just before you're about to get into jhanas. I don't know why that always happens. So what it shows you is your body is totally out of control. When it wants to get sick, it will get sick. And you can't do anything about it. It just shows you this body belongs to nature. It doesn't belong to you. And that's why for many people when they're sick, you know, it's quite a blow to their ego. They get very embarrassed sometimes. If you're so sick, you've got to get the nurse to clean your backside because you just pooed yourself. That's a wonderful teaching for people to realize they don't own their body. So there's a great lessons in sickness. So it really depends on how you use your sickness. And you can make great good karma with sickness if you have the positive attitude. And the last thing, the great teaching of Ajahn Chah, when I was really sick, he came up to me and said, "Don't worry, sickness is something to reflect upon. It won't last. You will either get better or you'll die." That's very reassuring. So next time you're sick, always remember that. It won't last. You either die or get better. Today, when I sat for meditation, I saw some yellow lights and some later some unstable purple lights. I reminded myself to be kind and mindful, not to be excited. At the same time, I was able to listen clearly to all the noise in the meditation hall. Is that normal while hearing still there when seeing nimitta? Yeah, that part of it is okay. When the nimitta start coming up, you can still hear the noise, but sometimes it's not a distraction. It's like hearing a noise a long distance away. So in other words, your five senses are closing down, but they haven't closed down totally yet. And the sound is the last thing which disappears. However, while I kept reminding myself to be kind and mindful during meditation, I did not feel any happiness arises, which I'd expected. That was the problem. When you expect something, expectation is the opposite of inspectation. You're looking outside something, somewhere in the future, wanting something to happen. Inspectation, the opposite of expectation, you look inside this moment. And then you don't have these problems. And then happiness comes. But I felt a bit boring after keep watching the purple lights arose and disappeared. Anything wrong with me, please advise Ajahn. I am upset now, thank you. Yes, you're a hopeless case. No, you're not a hopeless case. Just can't. It's only the first day, for goodness sake. So you just keep with that purple light and just relax, be kind, and just be aware. And when you get so still, it's just so peaceful, it's so nice. Well, I've been just travelling all around the world, tiring myself out. This afternoon I had my first nice meditation for weeks. It was so blissful just to sit here and just absolutely still doing nothing. Oh, just what joy. So it's just so easy to do. Just let go, for goodness sake. Let go of expectations. And then you're content. When you want something more, you want the happiness, you want the lights, you want something more, that is the reason why you can't enjoy what you already have. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. It's a great saying. So true. So what you have, you got lights? Wonderful. Do you want some more? It's amazing what people want. They get jhanas. No, it's not enough. I want second jhana. Second jhana. No, I want third. I want psychic powers. I want everything. Then you get nothing. Is there any benefit in practice other meditation methods such as Qigong? Has the Buddha introduced those physical activity-based meditations? Thank you. Well, keep it simple. You can do Qigong if you get bored, something else to do. But, you know, it's just do the basic meditation. It's all letting go. It doesn't matter what you let go of, as long as you're letting go, as long as you're being mindful and being kind. But if you're doing Qigong to get something, to live to 120 years, that's a waste of time living to 120 years. Who wants to live to 120 years? Look, you know, there's going to be global warming, the terrorists are going to take over, the economy's going to be shot. And the environment is going to be damaged. Do you really want to live to 120 years of age? As for me, I follow I used to watch The Doors, Jim Morrison, live fast, die young. That's my motto as a monk. No, it's not. I'm only joking. Live fast, die young. No, I live slow. Live peacefully. And die whenever you have to. So, the Buddha never introduced physical activity-based meditations except for maybe walking meditation. But you can do it. There's nothing wrong with it. Dear Ajahn, what exactly is noble silence? How does it differ from not speaking? How does it benefit self and others on retreat? Many people on this retreat seem to think that if they only whisper to their friends, they are keeping noble silence. Okay, I expected comments like this after two or three days, not the first day. Number one, what does noble silence really mean? Noble silence on my retreats means you don't have a bell to wake up at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. There's no bell to get you up for lunch. There's no bell to tell you to get up and walk or bell to make you sit down again. On some retreats, there's a bell every hour. We don't have bells on this retreat. You get up when you feel you need to. You go to bed when you need to. You meditate when you need to. You walk meditation when you need to. You have a cup of tea when you need to. You're not like these dogs by Professor Pavlov, always being conditioned to do this and to do that. So this, because we have no bells, this is a no bell silence retreat. That is the meaning of no bell silence. And it's only on retreats like this where we don't have bells to get you to get up and walk down again. Only retreats like this do some people actually win the Nobel Peace Prize. In other words, that's called jhana, the Nobel Peace Prize. But when you're talking about talking and talking to each other, this is not like a concentration camp when we can have guards, we can have like policemen around to try and catch people who talk. And if you talk, you get beaten up. You get put in the dungeons for 3 days without any food. That'll teach you a lesson. I mean, you're adults. So that discipline always must come from inside, not from outside, not from fear of punishment. So it's a self-discipline. And the way to have that self-discipline, you know, to be aware, to be mindful and kind. And when you speak to someone, is it really necessary? Are you being kind to them and kind to yourself? A lot of time it's just a bad habit. You know, we think we need to sort of say, I'm here, okay, so, you know, to say something to somebody. It's much better to contemplate, can you improve upon the silence? If you can improve upon the silence, then speak. If you can't, shut up. And it's very hard to improve upon silence. Such a beautiful thing. So if you really respect and love and worship silence, you won't speak so much. So what to do if someone speaks to you or whispers to you? If you say to them, shut up, then you are as bad as they are. You are also speaking. So instead, if someone speaks to you, just the one finger sign, I don't mean the, you know, the usual one finger sign, just one finger. Say that to them. That means you're not breaking your silence and you're reminding other people. You don't have to speak back. And then you can walk away. You don't get into this conversation or argument. And you find it so wonderful just being, you know, in a room with 5 other people, being in this retreat center. You don't have to speak. And you find after a while it's so comfortable just being with other people, no needing to speak. Any social interaction, you can just smile at someone to say hello. Now smile. Smiling is not breaking noble silence. Some people think on a meditation retreat, the real serious ones are the ones who never smile. I'm here for enlightenment, not for fun. And that really is a miserable retreat. So at least you can smile at each other, but you're not allowed to speak to each other. And if you see someone who's really, really depressed, then just make a face at them. Make them laugh, for goodness sake, because laughing is not breaking noble silence. You can laugh. But don't speak. And if there's anyone who really, really, in your cottage, just can't stop speaking, bring them to Dania. We've always got the last resort, the masking tape. And we put a little hole in there. We supply you with a straw so you can still drink and eat sort of non-solid foods. Now we must order food up for you so you can still suck it through a straw, but you'd have to wear the masking tape until the end of the retreat. Be warned. Yes, Rushy P.
And after that, when the Buddha asked them about their retreat, they said that they followed the vow of silence, and the Buddha represented them.
Yes.
Why is that?
Why is that? Because none of the monks were teaching the lay people. So the monks were very silent. during the rains retreat for 3 months. But part of the job of a monk is actually to look after the people who supply them with the food. So it's okay to keep a vow of silence for 2 or 3 weeks as long as there's another monk teaches the Dhamma to people. If they'd have done that, there would have been no problem. But they were so silent when people came to their temple and asked for a Dhamma talk. When they asked the way to the toilet. And of course they would complain after a while. So that's why that went too far. But you know, you're on retreat. I was on retreat for 6 months, as you know. And I never spoke to a human being for 6 months. Not one word. But that was for 6 months, but other monks were doing the teaching for me. And if you haven't spoken, kept noble silence, that silence for six months, it's so hard to speak again. You know, I had a headache for 3 days because I had to speak. People said, "How are you doing? What happened?" You had to learn again how to, not just to speak, you had to learn how to think, because your mind was so silent and so still. You know, you had to force the brain to think again. So, you know, silence is beautiful. Once you get into it, you don't really like coming out. So try and be still, try and be silent. You know, it's great for you and great for others. So the first day, I had a few whispers. Okay, enough now. You know, you said hello to each other. Everyone knows who they are. Now see if you can be silent. And don't disturb the silence. Try and be quiet. Dear Bhante, I observe a long gap between in and out breath. What does the mind do during this time? I tend to just think of the long gap. Sadhu, you know what you do? You're just aware and kind to the long gap. So you're kind to it. You don't try and lengthen it and see if you can beat your record. If you try that, you might die. You might asphyxiate yourself. And that's really embarrassing for this retreat center. So we've never had any casualties yet. We don't try and have any casualties, otherwise the council might close us down. So please, always remember to breathe in again after you breathe out. You do that and you live a long life. So what the mind does during this time, what is happening here is because you may be watching the breath rather than the stillness. If you watch the breath, when the breath stops, you don't know what you're supposed to be watching. So instead, see if you can notice the stillness rather than the breath. And then you've always got something to watch and to observe. You understand what stillness is. And your mindfulness gives you some feedback to see whether that stillness is getting more solid, more deep, or whether you're getting more agitated. So stillness is more important than watching the breath. The breath is just a way you can see how still you are. But the stillness itself is the best thing to watch. So that's the answer to that question. Can I count my steps during walking meditation? Yeah, there must be an accountant who's asking this question. You know that many people are accountant and business people, they love numbers. So that's why they want to count steps during walking meditation and count their breaths. 1, 2, I'm sure they get the calculator out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can if you want, but that's a bit too busy. If you really are restless, then okay, you can do the counting of the steps when you're doing the walking meditation. But after a while, just let go of all the counting and just step. And just keep it as natural as possible. When you're going for a walk in the forest, do you count the steps? You know, when you're walking to work, do you count the steps? It just adds an extra layer of busyness to the mind. If it's a way of focusing your mind, okay, but just don't count them too long. When I reach the wall, I feel disrupted and a break in the smooth walking. How to overcome this? Surely I can't walk through the wall yet. Ha 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 ha. Huh? How do you know? Just don't follow beliefs. Give it a try. Have faith. See what happens. But if you do that, if you try that, please borrow the crash helmet so you don't actually get too many bumps on your head. Well, if you really want to, you can get out on Kingsby Drive on the front road and just do that. You can walk all the way to Carnet Prison Farm, which is how many, about 8 kilometres up the road? Actually, you can walk all the way around, because Kingsbury Drive goes all the way around to Jarrahdale, and then from Jarrahdale to the South West Highway and round again. It's about 42 kilometres. You don't have to stop. So that way you won't be disturbed. No, sometimes the reason it's good to turn around and walk in meditation, if you keep on going, some people, they start to lose their mindfulness. They start to fantasize, dream, plan, or whatever. At least you have to stop when you get to the end of the wall. Stop and turn around. It gives you a chance of coming back into the moment. And it's also, I like the idea, if you turn around, you come back again. You always end up where you started, which is part of life. We always think we're getting somewhere, don't we? But where do we really get? We just come back to where we started, all the time. In a few days we'll have the end of the retreat, because they bye-bye, and then they come back again. How many times have you left this retreat place and you come back again? Or you're here for the first time, ha ha ha, you'll be back. So that is what happens. We just go round and round in the circles of life. So that's what to do there. Respectful greetings to Ajahn Brahm. How are a super sanya and nibbida different from the fault-finding mind? How do we give proper value to gratitude and contentment on the one hand, and to asubha and nibbida on the other hand? They seem contradictory. Okay, asubha is looking at the ugly parts of life, or the ugly part of food. We do this to balance, because sometimes people have got too much greed. Have you seen how much food some people put on their plates? The plates, doesn't matter how big you put the plates, the food is like a mountain on the top. You wonder, how on earth can someone eat that much? And it's just because of craving, desire. So, if you are eating too much, try this. When you put the food on the plate, nice and delicious, remember, you're going to put that food in your mouth, and the body's going to take out what it needs. And what comes out the other end is this brown, sticky, smelly stuff. Where did that brown, sticky, smelly stuff come from? It must have been in that food from the very beginning. But just covered up, you know, with the nutrients and the proteins and the stuff which you really needed. But that shit is on the plate of food. It doesn't come from somewhere else. So you look at that plate of food, and there's a shit which comes out of my backside is in there somewhere. You know, that what you're eating is shit plus, you know, the proteins, carbohydrates and vitamins. That's all it really is. The good stuff gets taken out and the bad stuff is what's left, which is quite substantial. So I don't know what it is. Maybe, 70% of what you put on your plate ends up as shit? Probably. So that's what you're eating. So you look at that and you think, my goodness, I am eating shit plus a few proteins, carbohydrates and vitamins. That's what it is. And that's called asubha, and that means you don't want to eat so much. So we have all these little tricks as monks like this, just in case, you know, you eat too much. So what is that from fault-finding mind? The fault-finding mind just dwells in negativity. This seeing the negative side of things, it just balances, you know, the greeds and the lusts, and then the personal desires which people have. And then what that means, it's just a balancing mechanism. But quite honestly, that too many monks especially, and nuns, do asubha sanya. You know, they start contemplating the body as just a pile of shit. They just see just all the stuff on the outside, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin, as dead stuff. And they're skeletons, they're just rotting skeletons. And sometimes they become so morbid, they become really sort of psychological cases. Sometimes they take it too far. It's just meant to balance that all and not to get the fault-finding mind, which is one of the reasons why every one of you have already got enough fault-finding mind. So we want to actually develop the opposite of asubhasanya, subhasanya, the perception of the beautiful. It's great when you develop this perception of the beautiful. For most people, that is what they really need. Beautiful food. Isn't it wonderful? The people who came today put so much effort into getting a variety of food. Really delicious. I hope you enjoyed it. And so you have this wonderful sense of gratitude. All the people who are coming on this retreat, they're trying their best. They may still be banging their doors, but you know they're making great efforts. Wonderful. Thank you so much for the privilege of living with five other people in my cottage who are trying to do the best to develop themselves and practice the Dharma. And you know, the people who made this retreat and people like Bianca who work really hard managing and making sure that everyone's okay, you feel this great sense of gratitude and love. And that gives you this joy inside of yourself. And you look at yourself, yeah, you can see all the faults inside of yourself, but put those aside and develop the subhasanya of yourself. Yeah, you may not be the best person, but as I said last night, the crooked trees in the forest are the most beautiful ones. Yeah, you know, you're gnarled, you're damaged, you've got a few branches missing, but that makes you beautiful. That's why you belong here in the forest. And that's called subhasanya, the perception of the beautiful. And if you do that, that means you're looking at the beautiful, then you get your happiness in meditation. This is one of the problems when somebody said earlier, they get nimittas, they haven't got any happiness. You need to develop more subhasanya, to see the beauty, to go out and see the beautiful heavens, the wonderful full moon, to spend time just maybe sitting with a cup of tea, just watching over the valley. Just what a beautiful sight that is. There's so much beauty in this retreat center. It's very hard to see faults. Which is why you develop that. And then it makes you so happy, so positive. When you just start meditating, you're so positive towards yourself. You're just letting go, having a wonderful time. Or just being able to watch one breath, that's good enough for me. So positive that you get into the deepest of meditations. Subhasanya should be developed first. As far as the nibbida comes, that comes after the jhanas. Wait, do the subhasanya first of all. The gratitude and contentment. All the other things come later. Oh, here we go again. Can you please explain the difference between samatha and vipassana? I just do meditation with your audio instructions. When others ask what type of meditation I do, I just get confused. Thank you. You do the Buddha's meditation. Tell them you do Third Noble Truth meditation, as I say. Because this is another of those terrible myths which have developed in meditation circles in the West. I do Vipassana meditation. That's a real meditation, the only way to enlightenment, which is totally false, totally against the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha never said that, not once, anywhere, in any place. The only way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. So there has been a confusion on people in the West saying Vipassana is the way, the best. Do jhana first, okay. Samatha first, and then go to the real teaching, Vipassana. That is sort of egotistical, arrogant stuff, showing of conceited people. The way my teacher taught, he would put up his hand again. He didn't have many visual aids, but his hand. And he would say, this is the front of the hand. Can you all see the front of my hand? You can't see the back of my hand now, but I guarantee my back of my hand is there. Now you can see the back of my hand, but you can't see the front. But the front hasn't disappeared, it's still there. So that's Vipassana, that's Samatha, the front and the back of the hand. You cannot split them off. Yeah, you can think you're doing Samatha because that's what you see, but Vipassana is right behind. You think you do Vipassana, but Samatha is right behind. You cannot split them. That was Ajahn Chah's saying again and again and again. They always go together. And my simile, which those of you been here before have heard umpteen times. There was this couple, husband and wife. The husband was called Sam Atta. And the wife was called Vipassana. And after lunch one day, they decided to go up for a walk to climb to the summit of Meditation Mountain. And this is the extra one which I add. And Sam and Vi took their dog, who was called Metta. Sam went up the mountain because he wanted to enjoy the peace. Wow. And that's the example of the volcano effect I was talking about earlier. Very good. Thank you, Lynn. So Sam went up Meditation Mountain for the peace. Vi, she went up Meditation Mountain for the view. She took her Canon camera up there to take insight shots. And what did Metta the dog do? Dogs are just so simple. Metta just went up there for fun. So when they got halfway up Meditation Mountain, it was so peaceful. Sam was already really happy. It was so quiet halfway up Meditation Mountain. And his wife, Vi, who went up there for the view, she could see so far halfway up. So she was taking all these great insight shots. She could put in her enlightenment folder when she got back. And as for Metta the dog, only halfway up, and she was already wagging her tail. She was so happy. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, it was so still up there. Sam was just so content, so peaceful up there and calm. But Sam had a pair of eyes. He could also see the view. And Vi, oh, you could see forever, everything, the whole world from on top of Meditation Mountain. So she was getting all these great insight snaps on her camera. But she could also feel the deep peace. And as for Metta the dog, she could feel the peace and see the view also. But she had so much love, she was licking both of them. Because that's what a dog does to show it's happy. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, those three things coexist. Peace, insight, and love. Metta. Sometimes we just Vipassana Samatha. It's not. Sometimes Vipassana Metta. The three go together. If you understand that, you understand what meditation is. Not as theory, but as reality. Now, last one. How does water travel upstream to take the Buddha's bowl? A metaphor, perhaps, or an eddy in the stream. Who knows? Maybe it was one of those nagas, one of those heavenly beings who flew against the current. People like weird stories, but this was one of those. I told a story the other day in Indonesia because they like strange stories, especially of kindness and what happens when you're kind. This was a story from the tsunami in Sri Lanka. Many of you may know this story, it's quite well known. There was a man who would, every morning before going to walk, would take some bread and feed the fish in a local lagoon before going to work. A little bit of dana just for the wildlife. And one day when he went to the edge of the water, it was not just the fish there, but was a crocodile. And the crocodiles in Sri Lanka eat people. They are dangerous. But this guy just threw it two slices of bread, and the crocodile ate the bread and swam away. And from that time on, he'd always give two slices of bread to his crocodile. The crocodile must have been an English person in its previous life because it liked bread. Then anyway, one morning he was feeding his crocodile and the fish when the big wave hit early in the morning. The tsunami came. And he got caught in the big wave and carried out to sea. And they describe, I mean, you know the story of the tsunami. there are such eddies in that water that you try and grab onto something, and the force of the current is so strong, it is, you get separated, pulled away from anything you try and hold onto. The first thing he tried to hold on to was a chair just to give himself some buoyancy. But the current tore the chair away from him. But the next thing was a log of wood, and he managed to hold on to that log of wood. And in the confusion, you know, struggling to hold on to this wood to keep him afloat, that's when he noticed something strange. Everything else was flowing out to sea, but the log of wood was flowing against the current to the shore. He got so close to the shore he could jump off the log of wood and scramble up the bank to dry land. He'd survived. It was only then he realized his log of wood had a tail and a big mouth. It was his crocodile. Because he'd been kind to this crocodile, the crocodile had, you know, seen him, saved him, and brought him back to land again. Whether that was just from compassion or just greed, because if that guy died, he would get no more bread. I'm not sure. But I like to feel that it was out of kindness and gratitude that even animals can show gratitude for someone who's been kind to them. That was a true story. You heard that before, surely, the crocodile in Sri Lanka during the tsunami. So that kindness is very beautiful. And so, during this retreat, you're not allowed to speak to each other, but you're always allowed to be kind to each other, to open the door for someone. If they need a hand, just to give them a hand. If you see them, you know, they look at some food and they really want it, you take it and put it on their plate for them. You know, you make some merit. This is an offering to you. Whatever it is, those little acts of kindness during a retreat in a community really count for a lot. They bring some joy and happiness. So remember, always be kind and be aware, but no need to speak. Be silent, or I warn you, the masking tape will come out. Very good. So any more comments or questions? Very good. So it is actually just past 9 o'clock. Let's see, Al's questions. I lingered on his question because there's only a few of them. It's usually twice as many. And those of you who still haven't got peaceful meditation, how many of you have borrowed the teddy bear yet and did teddy bear meditation? Oh, it's so nice. A really nice soft teddy bear. It's really soft and lovable. So if you're having a bit of trouble meditating, just take the teddy bear and do teddy bear meditation. Because loving kindness, metta, vipassana, insight, and stillness, they always go together. Okay, very good. So, that finishes the question night. So what do we do now? Sadhu! 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 Very good. You must have got the three hee-hee-hees. Yeah. Okay, so those of you who want to carry on meditating, the hall is open here all night. If you want to go to bed, have a nice sleep. Get up whenever you feel like you need to get up. If you get up too early, it doesn't matter. You can always go to bed again afterwards. And just have a nice time here. The retreat is for you. So the halls are for you. Use it whenever you need to. You can meditate in your rooms. But remember, please be quiet in your rooms. Please be quiet in your cottage. Remember, be burglar. If you make the tea or you need to say something, be quiet. Because sometimes people are sleeping. If they're not sleeping, they may be so close to getting to jhanas. And because you bang the door, you stop them getting into jhana. Oh, what bad karma that is for you. Be careful. Okay, so good night and have a good sleep.